There we go. Oh, that's even better. Okay. So when I said, could you hear me, you're supposed to go like this. So because I'm a particle physicist, there's a lot of... You got to turn that one down a bit. You know, there's a lot of people here who are actually involved in entanglement experiments at the University of Toronto Physics Department. And I promise that I'm not, Henry, I am not going to talk about Bob and Alice, okay? So the... What we will do today is look at some very interesting pieces of physics that come together. So CPT symmetry, I'll talk about what that is, the quantum arrow of time or weak arrow of time and time reversal violation, CP violation, the EPR entanglement, and then how we actually probe new physics at high energies with precision measurements. Well, then also just touch briefly on a measurement that, if confirmed at the next generation experiment, could well break the standard model and point the way forward. And if I have time, I'll talk a bit about preparing for the next generation, the Bell 2 experiment. So CPT symmetry, let's just focus on the C part. If you consider a transformation of our universe, all particles are interchanged, replaced by their antiparticle partners. So this C conjugate, charge conjugation operator, this, I'm not sure why it's not making it across the room. Is there another one? Okay. Anyway, so the charge conjugation operator takes the A, turns it into A bar, particle into antiparticle, and that when you have C invariance, the observables of the reaction are unchanged under this operation. So all the rates, the energy momentum distributions, final states, they're not changed at all. The P of the CPT, the parity, take X, Y, Z, change it minus X minus Y minus Z, and that... it changes, in fact, effectively changes the direction of the momentum, but it doesn't change the angular momentum. So it has an effect of converting the handedness of a particle. So one of the proxies for handedness is the helicity. So the spin, if it's aligned with the momentum, we call that right-handed. If its spin is counter-aligned with the momentum, we call that left-handed. So by applying a parity operator, you actually change the helicity. The last one, T, is a transformation where you take all the T's in your equation and change them minus T's, right? So you have a situation, let's see if I can get this to work. I can't find my mouse here. The mouse doesn't seem to go over there. How do I make this? Oh, this is kind of weird. Oh, there we go, okay. Have to see the display, it actually moves around. So that will, shoot. Versus that, okay? You're running the movie backwards, okay? Very simple idea. Not to be confused with this, okay? The statistical mechanics arrow of time, right? Where entropy increases, there's more ways to construct a more disordered system in the universe than at a time t plus delta t than there are to construct an ordered one, right? That's not the time arrow that we're talking about, okay? So don't get confused by that. In fact, it has nothing to do with this weak arrow of time, which we're interested in today. So just to summarize, charge conjugation, all particles replaced by the antiparticles, parity, change R to minus R effectively, and T, change all the T's to minus T's. And with this symmetry, CPT symmetry, the transformed universe would evolve exactly under the same physical laws as the untransformed universe, okay? So any locally Lorentz invariant quantum field theory must have this symmetry. Right? It's the foundation of quantum field theories, and in fact, these are the most stringently tested theories in physics. They explain electromagnetism, the weak interaction, the strong interaction. So if we break CPT, that's pretty big stuff. Okay? It predicts, for example, that particles and the antiparticles have the same mass and the same lifetimes. And in fact, it's tested in many systems. And, okay, I'm an experimentalist, okay? Somebody says particles and antiparticles have the same mass, so what do? I go out and measure it and test it, make sure that's true, right? You do it with your masses, you do it with a lifetime. But then in many, many systems, the most stringent test comes from looking at the mass difference between the K0 meson, the K0 bar meson. So it's a very, very stringently tested there. But at every time we have an opportunity to test this, we want to do it. Thank you. Okay. Ooh, that's much better. So what it means is that, you know, if you actually, if we have CP violated, okay, then T must also be violated, and the magnitude of the violations must be precisely compensating for each other. So what do I mean by CP? Well, it means applying the charge conjugation and then the parity operator. So it's basically taking into account the handedness of the particles. The particles and antiparticles would have indistinguishable interactions under this symmetry. And it's actually true, but almost true, but there's an exception. That's the thing that's kind of interesting for our experiments. So what about this quantum arrow over time? You can ask the question, are the quantum laws of physics invariant under time reversal? Well, because we have this small amount of CP violation, you expect to see some violation of time invariance. Okay, again, an experimentalist, so what do? You measure that. Can we actually measure and make sure that that violation of time invariance is as you would expect under a CPT symmetry? And if it's not, then it's a big deal because you've just broken CPT. I told you all of our quantum field theories depend on that. So let me, before going and explaining how we actually do that, I know everyone here is not that familiar with particle physics, so let me just go through a bit of a primer on it. All right, so we, in our particle physics, we have the interactions, the strong, electromagnetic, and weak, and they act on these particles. The strong interacts on quarks and gluons, electromagnetic on any charged particle, the weak interaction on basically every particle. Okay, the gauge bosons mediate the interactions, and now we have the Higgs bosons that are generating the mass. We organize the mass particles into three generations of spin half fermions. So these are mass families. So this is the lightest, middle, heaviest. And the leptons, the electron, muon, and the tau, and their corresponding neutrinos are written in these things that look like spin doublets, but they're actually isospin doublets. You'll see in a minute why we do that. Similarly with the quarks, we have the up and down quark, the charm strange, and the top and bottom written with the same sort of notation. Right? So fermions, they can radiate. If they're charged, they'll radiate electromagnetic with a photon. Otherwise, they can also radiate the Z0 gauge boson. So a charged lepton will radiate both Z and the gamma. Neutrinos, which don't have any electric charge, will radiate Z0s. And the quarks will radiate Z0s and photons. But they, because they are the only strongly interacting fermion, they will also radiate gluons. And the gluons, of course, can radiate gluons themselves as well. Now, the point is that these are not changing the identity. What you start with is what you end up with when you have these types of radiations. You also have fermions with mass can also radiate the Higgs without changing its identity. Okay? Now, what's interesting in the weak interaction is that if you have elements of those doublets, remember I was writing them as doublets, you get this what we call a weak isospin, and you can actually change the identity of a lepton into its neutrino by emitting a W, where you change a D-type quark into a U-type quark and emit a W. So those are actually changing the, by emitting a W, you're changing the type of particle. Okay, that's, all right, and it turns out the weak interaction doesn't respect this parity. Remember, the parity is R goes to minus R. Right? There's a different behavior for right and left-handed fermions. The charged weak current, the Ws, right, the ones that are actually doing this isospin flipping, changing the charged lepton into a neutrino, down type into an up type neutrino, okay, these will only operate on left-handed particles. The charge current is blind to right-handed particles. And in fact, there are no right-handed neutrinos. So when you write these doublets, you only can write them for the particles as this put this little L there because only the left-handed particle can see this happening. We write the right-handed particles as what we call singlets, and because there is no neutrino to correspond to them. Similarly with the quarks, they have the same property. The other piece of information is that all the fermions have anti-fermion partners with opposite handedness. Okay, so the handedness changes. So now these doublets for the positron, the positive muon and a positive tau and their corresponding neutrinos, the antiparticles have a little R here. They're all right-handed, and the left-handed particles are singlets, similarly with the quarks. Right? The last thing to remind you about is that the quarks are confined by the strong interaction to hadronic Brown states, the most prevalent are the baryons, the three quark states, and the mesons, quark-anti-quark states. So today we'll be talking a lot about B0s and B0 bars and K0 bars. This is the quark content, a downstrange bar, strange down bar, changes a K0 into a K0 bar. And similarly for the B meson, you're switching an anti-B through quark in that meson tube, a B quark. So the weak interaction maximally violates C and P. You can see this, and again, it's a statement about the W bosons being purely left-handed. So if you take the charge conjugation on a left-handed neutrino, it turns it into a left-handed antineutrino, right? Changing the particle to an antiparticle. Take the parity, change a left-handed neutrino to a right-handed neutrino. Problem is, the left-handed antineutrinos and the right-handed neutrinos don't exist. But if you actually apply CP together, then you get the left-handed CP on left-handed neutrino is a CP is a right-handed antineutrino. It does exist. So for a while, people thought that CP would be a good, well-conserved property, almost on the same level as the CPT. But in 1964, CP violation was discovered in the decays of neutral kaon mesons. So I'm going to explain a little bit about this. So the neutral kaons appear as short-lived mesons and long-lived mesons. The short-lived mesons have this lifetime of 0.09 nanoseconds. The long-lived ones have 0.05 microseconds. So you can easily tell what you're dealing with. But the actual content of this is a K short, is made up of a K0 and a K0 bar with a addition between them. The K long is a K0 with a K0 bar with a minus between them. So that means that the CP, if you change the particle into antiparticle, this has a positive CP eigen value. The K shorts always decay to two, in principle, under CP conservation, they would always decay to two pions. The two pions have a CP plus eigen value. K longs, on the other hand, would be have the opposite CP eigenvalue, so they're minus, and they would decay to three pions. So that's if CP is conserved. What their experiment, Cronin and Fisher's experiment, found was that the long-lived ones actually decayed to the two pion final state, which means there's a little bit of CP plus in the state. So this picture is not completely accurate. In fact, it was a very small effect; only 0.2% of the decays went that way. But it's enough to shake up the field, right? So we knew that CP wasn't actually conserved. Now, it turns out last month, Jim Cronin died. Val Fish died last year. He had his obituary in the New York Times, which is kind of interesting to read, and they were quoting from some of his interviews in a book that was written about him. And they were commenting, he actually did his Nobel laureate winning experiments, this thing that I was just describing, when he was in his 30s, I think. But he didn't get the Nobel Prize 16 years later, and the interviewer was asking him, is that a problem? And he has this very interesting statement. He said, for me, it was actually a good thing. I was much too young at the time to deal with such a thing as a Nobel Prize. Right? So those of you that are working in the lab and your entanglement experiments, you think you've got it, right? Don't worry that you're not getting the Nobel Prize when you're in your 30s. You can wait until you're in your 40s. It'll be fine. Okay? But anyway, it's a kind of a sad loss to the field. He's a giant in the field. But the question arises, how do we explain the CP violation in the kaon system? So the quark states involved in the weak interaction are not the same as the quark mass eigenstates. So in fact, the mass eigenstates are those that are forming the baryons, the mesons, and the weak eigenstates are those that are actually undergoing this W and Z interactions. So in fact, they're mixtures, all right? So this was developed in the early 60s, actually, by Khabibol. And he was describing this mixing with two generations that were known at the time, with this mixing angle with a little C that stands for Khabibol. So you can actually mix the mass eigenstates to get these weak eigenstates. So this was known in the 60s, but then in the 70s, two other theorists in Japan, Kobayashi and Moskawa, were trying to explain CP violation. And they said, well, if we didn't have two generations, but we extended this picture to three generations, then one of the elements in this matrix is going to be an imaginary phase that, in fact, would generate CP violation. This is actually a really interesting thing that happened because these guys developed this theory before people knew that there were three generations. Right? So they just said, what if there are three generations? Well, this is one of the consequences. So it was a very cool thing that actually happened. And they could make pretty strong predictions about the fact that CP violation should then occur in this, at that time, postulated third generation. So I don't think they even called it a B because they didn't know about it. But this matrix called the CKM, so Khabibol, Kobayashi, Moskawa, this 3x3 matrix actually is a unitary matrix, and the elements are describing the strength of the conversion when you kick out one of these W's. Right? You're changing one quark type to another quark type, kicking out a W. And it's a unitary matrix, so it has four independent parameters. One of them is this complex phase, and it's the only source of CP violation in the standard model. It can be parametrized by taking advantage of the fact that it's almost a unitary matrix. So it's, these are big elements, smaller elements off to the side. So there's relationships between these four parameters, lambda, A, rho, and eta, related to each of these elements in the CKM matrix. Eta is the imaginary phase that's responsible for the CP violation. So because it's unitary, it means that there's certain constraints. So if you take the dot product of the first column and the last column of that matrix I was just showing, you get this expression. Okay, it's zero because it's a unitary. And you can then graphically plot this on an imaginary real plane. So here's the CB, VUB, and VTB, TD. So this one is on that side. So that you actually have this triangle where you're drawing this and closing it to get zero. So the idea is that you can actually make many measurements to study that triangle, this so-called unitarity triangle, and the intention is to make measurements of each of the angles of this triangle. If that any angle is non-zero, it means you've got CP violation. But you make as many as possible to over-constrain these parameters A, lambda, rho, and eta. And new physics would then be revealed through discrepancies in those measurements. Right? So how do you see it? How do you see CP violation with B mesons, given this picture? So you have this theoretical framework that says you should see CP violation in the Bs. How do you see it? Well, just as with the kaons, the neutral B mesons participate in the interactions, a linear combination of these eigenstates, the B0 and the B0 bar, combined to form, we put a little L, that's not left-hand, that's a light, and then there's a heavy. And you change the phasing between those two, so you have something that's approximately CP plus and approximately CP minus. So these two states have slightly different masses, but the same lifetime. And it turns out they, in fact, oscillate. So you can start with a B0, and through these combinations, this sort of Feynman diagram where you're emitting W's and T's, you can actually change from a B0 into a B0 bar. And they will oscillate back and forth with a frequency of a period of 12 picoseconds. So this is measurement and very well measured period. So you know this thing's oscillating back and forth. So the basic idea is to compare a B0 bar rate to a particular CP final state and ask, is it the same as a B0 going to that same state? The FPC is the same state. So for an example, this FPC, J psi k short is a particular final state that has a CP minus eigenvalue. And you're asking the question, do these go to that same final state the same way? So the way you can actually observe this is through the interference of an amplitude where you have a direct production of the CP, B0 goes directly to the CP, or you can go through that mixing. Remember I told you that B0 can mix into the B0 bar, and then it decays, so it does this first. And then there's an interference between those diagrams. The diagrams actually look like this. This is the direct, and then the mixing. It goes through this mixing process before decaying. But the final states are the same. Right? So there, when you actually do the measurement, you're looking at the combination of this, and there's going to be a phase between that. And the phase that you pick up is the sensitivity to the CP violation. Okay, so how do you do this? You're starting with all you're measuring in your detector, in principle, if all you're measuring in your detector is the final state, you have this K short J psi, that's the state. You don't know what it's actually started with because the masses are the same, the B0 and B0 bar, they're very same. You can't actually distinguish that. So how do you tell whether you started with a B0, B0 bar? That's the trick and how we actually use the EPR entanglement. Right? So the E plus E minus B factors, you're colliding an electron and a positron here, and they are designed to, in fact, exploit EPR. Right? So the E plus E minus are tuned at a particular center of mass energy where you have a bound state of BB bar. That then immediately decays to a BB bar final state and nothing else. And this is in an entangled P wave state. So EPR tells us the state of a B meson based on the decay of its EPR entangled partner. Okay, the thing about, I'll make an editorial comment. EPR is kind of one of these things that these guys actually developed the theory, but then they made this statement, no reasonable definition of reality could be expected to permit this. In other words, they described it all and said it's all rubbish, right? And yet they get the credit for all of this, right? It's kind of weird, isn't it? I mean, I think it's weird. But, this has led to this sort of spooky action at a distance. So I just want to talk a little bit about what this is and entanglement. So I have with me a Upsilon 4S meson proxy. And in here, the first example I'm going to give is how an ocean physics colleague of mine told me how entanglement works. And you'll see that it's actually not really entanglement. But he says, okay, you've got two socks, okay? Okay. So there's that sock, and then another one here. All right, that sock, what color is that? Black, okay, good, all right. So it's kind of dangerous, somebody could be colorblind. Anyway, so they're coming out of the Upsilon 4S meson as a B0 and a B0 bar, and this travels over to you guys. Oops, you're going to have to open that bag. This travels over to you guys, and you make your measurement on what do you have. Pull it out, show everyone. White, what do you expect that one? Black. So to my, my colleague who's stuck in classical physics, he says, this is entanglement, okay? This is exactly not entanglement, okay? This is... All right, now how do you do it with socks? I was puzzling how you do this. So I dug through my drawer, and in fact, I found these two. Okay. What color is that?
That's kind of a mix of black and white.
Black and white. And what color is that one? Well, oh, here. look closer. What is it? No, it's white and black. She said it was because when they come out of the Upsilon 4S, the B0 and B0 bar, they're in this entangled state, right? So now they travel through space and don't open it yet. Okay? Now you're going to collapse the wave functions. No, but before you do that, the black and white, what does that mean? It means that you don't, there's two things that what it means. The black and white means that you don't know what it is. It's both simultaneously, all the time, okay? The thing that's interesting is that because they're entangled, I told you that there's a B0 and B0 bar. What else did I tell you about B0s and B0 bars? What do? They oscillate, right? Between each other. So as they're traveling through space, they're going from a B0 to B0 bar back and forth, okay? So when that's black, that one's white, and when that's white, that one's black when they're in phase, okay? Then you go, you measure that when you're collapsing that wave function. What color is your sock? Okay, now let's see you. You open yours. Yeah, open it. What do you see? Oh, that one's black too. Why? Because what? She waited. Yeah, she waited. She did it out of time. They weren't in phase, right? So these are actually 180 degrees out of phase. So that's actually the name. Here, I'll take my socks back because I need that. It gets cold in Victoria, yeah. So, I mean, these are sort of a fun analogy, but hopefully you know what entanglement isn't and gives you a sense of what it might be. It's always good to have pictures in our minds when we're talking about this kind of stuff. Even though these guys said no reasonable definition of reality could work this way, in fact it does, and it's not at all like black and white socks, right? Okay, these are classical things. All right, but what we do have, though, when we do have this Upsilon meson decay into a B anti-B bound state, it's in this entangled state, and it's simultaneously an entangled state of a C plus and a C, plus one and a minus one CP, okay? But the thing that's also interesting is that it can also be, if you take a different basis, it can be described in terms of a B0 and a B0 bar as well. So it's a different basis that you can describe the same entangled state in. So when a B decays, it's going to be in one of those four states. When it decays, it tells you what the other one is at the time of the decay because of EPR. Okay? But the other one is going to decay at a different time, just like you open socks at a different time. Right? So what you have to do is measure the two B mesons, and you have to make sure that you know the time between those two decays. Now, to do this is kind of tricky in an E plus E minus collider if it's just if the center of mass, if they both beam energies are the same. So what you do is give one of the beams more energy than the other one, and then you get a relativistic boost to separate the decays. So they're actually using relativity to separate the decay points where the B mesons decay. And then you reconstruct them. So you look for events where, for example, the decay is a lepton and a K minus, and that tells you at that point that you had a B zero bar. You go back, and then at this point it actually turns about to be in phase, so it's a B zero bar at that point. And it tells you then here this must have been a B zero at the time of its decay. This one then decayed to this CP minus state. So but because you've got the partner, you know what it started as. Without that partner, you don't know what the starting point was. And then what the experiment is to collect data looking at these decays and to look at the differences. So just to discuss a little bit about the experiments, there was two experiments doing this, one in Japan called Bell on the KKB collider, so that you can see two rings, the electrons and positrons. They're both different energies. At Bell, there's an 8 GeV and an electron beam and a 3.5 GeV positron beam. Babar at the PEP2 ring in Slack had a 9 and a 3 GeV beam. This is the data sample that we had. It's between the two experiments, there was over a billion B pairs. And so with this, using the relativistic boosts, you can actually measure the difference between them. Okay, this is Babar. This is a photograph of it at Slack. If you're going from San Francisco to San Jose, you're going to actually cross that LINAC that was used. And the Babar detector is actually located there. This is what it looks like. It's a sort of standard E plus E minus collider. It's got some tracking, so it's inside a solenoid. So you basically have a magnetic spectrometer. There's some particle identification. You measure the photon and electron energies, and you also measure whether or not you had muons or other neutral hadrons that get through all the way to the iron that serves as the return yoke of that magnet. There's a photograph of Babar. It's now dismantled because it took data until 2008. We've been analyzing data up until now. We're still publishing. I think we have 10 papers this past year. So the idea of the CP violation measurement is that, as I said, these are produced in a coherent state. The B0 can go to CP or directly or through this oscillation, similar with the B0 bar. So you then look for CP eigenvalues of minus 1, so this is a K-short J-psi decay, or a K-long J-psi decay, and you change the CP, and you can do both. These are two independent experiments, and you can actually do those measurements. The idea is that the symmetry is to measure essentially, what you're measuring is the difference in S0 and S0 bar, rates to that. And you expect to follow the sinusoidal curve with an amplitude which is related to the values of the plus or minus one. And this scientific data, which is in fact on the angle of that, the data is zero reference at the CP population. Any of those angles will come to the CP value. Once you do that, you take the difference, and you can see that there's a difference when you have a zero tag or bar tag, and that difference is its oscillation. So if there's violation, if the dosing violation is going to be flat, you can do it when the final state has minus or plus, you can see that the phase changes back. So in this way, the amplitude can be balanced, the amplitude just tells you directly the angle of one of the angles of that triangle. This is just a list of the measurements that start off the error bars, more and more data. But this is just this one measurement, this one angle. The whole program is involving measuring all three angles, the size, the quantities that you use to measure those, and I'm going to go just to tell you that when you look at some of the angles, alpha, beta, gamma, it's consistent with 3 degrees, and the sides form the rates of the measurement. And generally speaking, this is a precision measurement to end up with. Generally speaking, well described by the CKM framework for 2008 Nobel Prize given to the theorist of the Einstein theory. And what you see on this plot are the experimental constraints. So this is the sample data measure that I was talking about. And these are the same with the duct. Another one, the curves are actual rates, certain rates that are then tell you the size, size of the size of those. So that's GP. So you don't see it's consistent with the question now is, what about time reversal? You need to test the time conjugate process, and so you start with an initial state before you get to the final state. So you evaporate the same final state from the initial state sum of the time. The problem is to identify a conjugate pair of processes, i.e. the initial and final, where you can activate this, so you back and forth, and which can be used to experimentally test this time reversal state. It's very tough to do in fact. Know which time state before you did. And now we just showed that with entanglement, you can actually do that. You use a partner to tell you what time before you did. And then what we're looking at is the transition rate between labor items. So whether you started with a B0 or B1 and went to a CP+ or a CP-. So let's say with B0, you went to CP+. Then you compare going from CP+ to B0. You're saying, are those rates the same? One or two? Very straightforward, and this is what you get. So you take this asymmetry, this is what happened with B0 bar going to the minus state, this is the data as a function of time. So if there was no T violation, you would have this blue curve. CP plus going to B0, that's the difference between CP plus going to B0 and B0 to CP plus, again, you have this curve. So you're actually violating time delays at 4 seconds. And it turns out that these are, you can say, that is the amount that you're violating these variance consistent with what you expect under the CPT. CPT measured very precisely, predicts what the time variance amount should be, and it turns out that it is an excellent, you have both. But it's the first time that anyone's actually done something. You have to have a state, you have to get the time of first time. So the question, how do we access high energies? So I just want to point out that it's kind of analogous to what happens in the search for a planet. Like if some unseen planet is perturbing the orbits of other visible planets and other visible objects in a manner that is, in fact, a deviation from the mechanics of the juice that you've got in your planet. So you know what this story is, it's how major planets are discovered. And this year, we actually have this evidence of a real-life planet, Pluto. And in fact, you know, the evidence that was found at Caltech is getting stronger and stronger over the summer. But in particle physics, it's a similar sort of thing. You rely on quantum field theory, not just quantum theories. We depict them by these Feynman diagrams, which are in a perturbation theory. And the high-precision theory has been used in the past to predict masses indirectly before the discovery of energy. So we've actually done this sort of ninth planet search. A couple of examples of this happening. The first one is actually an example of this. It's a collapse on open where you're studying Z0 photon. And Z0 pertains to the fermion and fermion pairs. And what one of the things that we looked at was the rate at which the Z went to the B and to the core. And this is a diagram, a Feynman diagram, and it depends on the top point in the quantum field theory. So the rate at which it goes to this BB bar depends on this hypothesized top point. The time of the data is no one would solve the top point. You search for it, you have a time, and no one would see it. But by making this precision measurement, this is a measure, this is a measurement, and this is the mass of the top point, you say, oh, well, we can bound the top point where the red line crosses the blue band. The function of time, this is the limits on the top point mass as the data from Z or Z pertains to the bar. And then at some point, guess what? Right on top of the picture. It's kind of amazing. You know, the major accomplishment of the field theory is happening. Of course, I was on the other extreme. Precision measurements. Well, you guys know what it's going to be. The other more recent example, the Higgs boson. So again, precision measurements. Not as precise as prediction, but given some indication of where Higgs boson could be. And of course, the Higgs boson was discovered a couple of years ago. So the high luminosity plus or minus collisions of the EMS threshold are an exquisite tool for discovering the physics. They look for deviations in precision measurements, and you can also do direct searches of sound among integrated processes like this. And this way, you're indirectly searching for physics at very, very high frequencies. I'll just give you one example of something that's actually seen in the VAR data. So this is a decay of a B, a C quark, and kind of that bottom quark, a charm quark, the emission of a W, and third generation electrons. And by looking at the ratio of the B to B tau to B to B, LVL is a new one, and you do the same thing with an excited B. So this is, we do this ratio because it minimizes the statistical errors, so you don't know the absolute proportion of theory of the question experiment, you don't know the same thing, the ratio, collapse something uncertainty. So by taking the ratio, collapse a lot of that uncertainty, and when you plot this ratio versus that ratio, this is the measurement that we got, and each of these one sigma, two sigma, three sigma band, these are reasonably well predicted in the standard model we've shown up here. So in the color system, the bar was seeing more than two standard deviation evidence for excess, so it's outside of the standard model. So the standard model, other experiments last year, we're measuring this as well, and they got the headlines in they sent me this, the person writing this sent me the article, we were the first people to see that these guys were really, so they added us, they said, we can trim it. Sort of footnote. Physics Today also and the measurements that they made, in fact, are shown in this picture here. So this is the bar measurement. LHCb, the one at CERN, just made one of the measurements. So the others are down here. Bell made the blue. So there's consistency with the one standard deviation. When you average them together, you get the red ellipse. It's one sigma. It's standard model prediction. So go through the statistics, and it turns out that 3.4 sigma, in fact, the bar sigma grows to 2.9 sigma. This is the measure of the belt and the LHCb. So now we're looking at the next generation experiment. How do we resolve this? This is supposed to be 3.9 sigma, but we still don't know if this is right. We have to get more data, which is motivation for the next experiment. We need higher precision, much larger data set, and higher reach. So, CFB, a candidate, CFB, and then you get 40 times the intensity of the beam. How do you get it? Well, you double the currents and you squeeze the beam. So this is one beam passing through another AA collider, but just taking data in 2000. We're now trying to build this. Dark sector that explains dark matter, so it's my race. look for effects that have never been seen before. The dark photons are predictions that are affecting the rate at which you might see the dark photons versus the mass of that photon. These lines are what the sensitivity is to kind of push down these data to the depth of the mass. So the many, many measurements of the quick prediction program, and the idea, of course, is to search for deviations in the standard model and see something, and to look for the patterns of try and understand how those deviations occur. So how quantitatively, how quickly is it? So you can express the possibility for this potential correction. For example, mixing. So we told you about mixing, B0R. Well, maybe there's new physics that is changing this. Right? It's characterized by the strength of that interaction and the energy scale. So by looking at energy scales, you can see that you're actually way up in the sensitivity, depending on what your assumptions are about the strength. If you're able to decode multiple energy scale. This is what the belt looks like in last year. The green line is shown here. You can see the green pipes crossing. And in fact, we've been working on a commissioning of the accelerator. We first put the single beam in each of those specialized detectors that were put together to study the particles that are produced in those accelerators, the accelerator as it's being turned on. We were trying to understand if the chamber walls were clean enough, if the background was produced by the accelerator understood, so I'll talk about it a little bit more. One of the best accelerator settings to achieve these high currents and while minimizing background particles that are produced. So for example, this is not a perfect vacuum. It's not a perfect vacuum. The beam is actually going to interact with some of the residual gas, either just a lone scattering or a rupture on cross section. The other effect that occurs is the positron, the positive beam. And if you get electrons knocked off the walls of the vacuum chamber, those electrons, you see the positive beam, they break the beam on the background structure. So we just read the collider was actually designed with walls that were supposed to minimize this effect. And we want to see how well that would work. Another is to understand what happens when the beam size changes. So if you squeeze the beam down, you expect to see inside that beam particles interacting with each other. It's some kind of interaction you expect to be this beam interaction. So this is inside the beam. You have an electron versus an electron. And that, when you get those electrons out, it causes background. Slam into the beam pipe and have a radiation. So this is the rate of neutron being produced over 1 over the beam size. This is the it's called a Tushak effect. And that, you know, Tushak is a sort of father of plus. Now, this actually worked on my PhD students. We actually designed where we collected this data from this helium 3 neutron detector system. And this, one of the things we looked at was this very specific measurements from this experiment, showing that indeed we are seeing this scattering, and we're comparing it against simulations to make sure that it actually goes real quick. The other thing that's done when you first commission a collider is to clean off the walls by scrubbing. What it means is that you run a high current, the radiation from the high current beam knocks off the absorbents that are sitting in the walls of the vacuum chamber, and then you pump those away. So as you increase the beam dose, partial pressures of different molecules on the left should go down. These molecules should be actually released from this effect. So we want to see whether or not we're actually scrubbing on. My other PhD student working on this piece project, I designed both the collected data with a gamma ray detector system. And here's his data. So he's working with photon ray tracing. He goes, indeed, it's dropping. The other thing we were looking at was this electron cloud effect. We thought we had the accelerator dose that it wouldn't produce, but when we started turning up the current, wow, things took off the background lights were a mess. And so it turned out that the guy who designed it was just out. So they had to install have basically sucked these electrons back from the chamber. So that once you install those solenoids, then you didn't have to take off. So this is stuff that's in the spring. These are kind of fun picture. We actually managed to broader over, and anyway, let me finish by summarizing what we talked about today. So Velva barb is one dependent tool for measuring symptom violation of barb. Take a step further and measure violation of time versus. The amounts are completely agreement with standard model conditions of CBT. You're also searching for new deviations from standard model that would tell us something about physics at very high frequencies. We did find some tension in standard model. The barb data was then confirmed by LHC and Bell, so that significant.